So anyway, that's one of the things I've been driving is this whole font embedding thing. And so along with that, I wanted to start looking at web standards.
Can I just interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
Is it available right now? Like, if I get Internet Explorer 8 Beta 2, can I, like, use that?
If you got Internet Explorer 6, you could use it.
It's still the same
Internet
thing,
Explorer
right?
7, you could use it.
It's still the same thing.
It's like absolutely the same thing. It has always worked since 1996, Internet Explorer. I think Internet Explorer 4 was when they introduced
it. I was curious, is it like, for making it an open standard, if you, like, changed it, you know, in a way, so...
It's not changed in any way.
Okay.
It's exactly the same, and it works exactly the same as it always has done.
Okay.
It's just that the format is now going to be documented and open, so anybody can do the same thing. Right? And anybody can unpack it in their browser. Because that's what we really want. What we want to happen is for the Safari guys and the Mozilla guys and the Opera guys and any other browser to implement embedded open type. Then it becomes a standard. Then everybody can use it on the web.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah. And, you know, as we've said publicly, we are not going to support font linking. So we're not going to go that route that we believe encourages piracy. But we are going this route, and we're making it open and free and available to anybody else to do it, which I think is a pretty fair approach.
Yeah.
You know, so I believe that it made sense way back then to have a proprietary technology to do this. It makes no sense whatsoever today. So that's been kind of one of my major efforts. At the same time, I've been looking at web standards. You know, Internet Explorer 8, the Beta 2, is a really good web standards rendering browser. And it has ClearType in it, of course, which I'm kind of attached to, right? In fact, I can't live without ClearType.
Is there still a way to turn off ClearType in Internet Explorer?
Yeah, I'm sure there is. Yes, there is.
There was like a way, like, you know, there's a way in Windows, and then there's an own way in Internet Explorer, which was always like, why is that?
Yeah, I believe there is. You could certainly turn it. I know you can certainly turn it on. I'm assuming you can turn it off.
All right, so I'll let you get back to with the. Because you were finishing on the big dream on.
Yeah, IDA. I've been looking at Internet Explorer 8 as it evolved and as it came to support web standards. And I've been looking, so I realised that, you know what, Bill, you've been dumb for way too long. It's time you got your hands dirty in the HTML and CSS world. What I did was I started to produce a set of web pages, and I used a publishing application to lay them out, and then got it to spit out HTML and CSS. But what I discovered was that it spit out HTML that was completely incomprehensible to me, because there was all this proprietary lines of proprietary code and stuff like that in it.
What do you mean lines of proprietary
code? Oh, tons of it, you know.
You just mean markup stuff where it's just like ugly HTML or
I'm not quite sure how you describe it, but it's lines of like VML and stuff like that, you know?
Okay, so it's probably just, you know, garbage HTML is what it spits out.
It does. Not only garbage HTML, but incredibly verbose garbage HTML.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So one of the things that happened was, yeah, I did this set of pages really to demonstrate font embedding and how font embedding could look on the web. And I wrote a piece in the Internet Explorer blog, i.e. blog, and gave a pointer to these pages. And Chris Wilson had warned me about this up front. He'd said, you know, if you do that, there's a whole bunch of people that are going to jump on you for the state of the HTML in there. And I said, well, it's not really about the HTML, it's about the embedded fonts. I'm not an HTML guru. But sure enough, Chris was right, you know, the pages appeared, people said, to be honest, they were probably right. If I tried to use the W3C's HTML validation tool to validate the HTML on those pages, it got as close as I've ever seen a piece of software to swearing at me and calling me a moron. You know, there are 85 errors in this page, and it's not fixable.
Right.
You know, anyway, Chris warned me. It did happen. So then I started to look, and Chris took one of my pages that I created in his publishing application and started to work on a web standards version. He didn't finish it, but he'd done enough. I couldn't follow then, but I thought, you know, if I went away and learned a whole bunch of HTML and CSS and started to do this, hey, I could do this myself. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. I bought a stack of books, and I just went away. I didn't come into the office for weeks. And what I did was I deconstructed my pages, and I deconstructed Chris's HTML and the CSS, and figured out how to get font embedding working, and figured out a whole bunch of other things. And then I started to build standards-based versions of the same pages I'd posted on IE blog. And then I put those up. And the other thing that happened was I thought, you know, I don't want to test this stuff in the kind of artificial environment of the corporate network where I've got speeds and I don't have the latency and all that
right.
stuff. I want to do this for real on the web. So I bought a domain.
Okay.
It's called www.billhillsite.com. I bought a domain and I started to use that as a place to do all this experimentation. So I started off, the homepage kind of points to the original set of non-standards-based pages, and then there was a set of standards-based pages, and then I started to actually understand what I was doing,
mm-hmm.
and then I started to get really ambitious, because the layouts that I've been doing, for example, the reason I've been using a publishing application in the first place was I wanted two or three column layout in my pages, and Chris had figured out how to kind of munge HTML so that you could use three separate divs and you could do three column layout, but you had to
right.
kind of hand fill each of the columns.
Yes.
But then I went on the web and I found a JavaScript that did multi-column layout.
Oh, excellent.
And integrated that into the pages. And then suddenly, things were starting to look even better. And then, of course, I got really ambitious and I thought, I'd love to have hyphenation in there as well. And I found another JavaScript that did hyphenation, so I put that one in and got that one working. And then I also worked at the same time on a really, really clean separation between the HTML and the CSS. I've done 70 pages, I think, in the last 3 weeks. And I can put my hand on my heart and say there is not a single character of formatting in any of the 70 pages. In the HTML, it's all in the CSS.
Excellent.
Which was fantastic. The other big plus that happened, my original publishing application pages were 40k each page. The web standards version that I'm doing now are 7.
Yeah, wow.
So they load really quickly.
Of course.
Because what happens is when somebody hits the site, they hit the CSS first,
mm-hmm.
which then downloads the fonts, and then since all the pages use the same fonts, it's just
goes.
And how big are the fonts to download?
Well, the font objects. It's interesting. You can define what you want, how big you want the objects to be. You can define the weft tool, the Windows Embedding Font tool, for example. It allows you to decide on what basis you want to subset a font. So you can subset a font, just create a font object that only has the characters that are on this page.
Oh, interesting. So you can make it micro small, like let's just say you only had 3 letters.
If it was a heading, for example,
rather than downloading an entire
yeah.
font.
Well,
yeah.
that's how it is in Word, right? So it's the yeah. same thing.
Yeah. Or maybe I want a website that only covers the English language. Therefore, we can strip out all of the Greek and the Cyrillic and all the special characters and stuff like that. Out of there, or I want a website that allows editing, in which case I might need to put the whole font in, not subset it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can. There are various axes by which I can cut or increase the size of the font in ways that make sense. So, So the pages are about 7k each.
Did you want to show us? Or?
Yeah. So what I did, I've been blogging for some time. I started off blogging in live spaces, and I also created a blogger blog. And I've been blogging in both of those, and I hate the way that blogs read. It's horrible. They allow for a kind of a pseudo multi-column layout on the first screenful.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute you go down below that, you're stuck in this big, long line of text, and it's just horrible to read. And, of course, all the rest of your screen is wasted. So that's one of the first things I wanted to look at was what a blog could look like if you had font embedding, if you had multiple column support and hyphenation, and you paid attention to fonts and all that stuff.
A lot of these sort of things that you're looking at are really sort of either book publishing or things that people consider classic print.
Yeah.
Like you're describing a number of the qualities of what's been going on in print, but now you're saying you can bring it to the web.
Yeah, well, here's the other thing that, I mean, I've actually had somebody be critical of me for, your stuff just looks like print. You know?
Oh, as a criticism.
Yeah, as a criticism. I don't know what I've done with my chair here, but it suddenly sank down. I'm like miniature. That's probably not bad for showing this stuff off. So, yeah, I had somebody actually critical of it. Now, what they don't realise is that print and the way that things are done in print is not just a convention.
It's how the eye works, right?
It's how the eye works, and it's how we evolved the display of text and information over a period of 550 years since Gutenberg mechanized printing. We've had 550 years of Darwinian evolution to try things that worked and things that didn't work, and what worked survived, and that's what we see in print today. That's why if you open a book, the text is always about the same size, right? And the columns mm-hmm. are always about the same width, and because it's all... nobody consciously thought that way and designed it back 500, 300, 200 years ago. But it naturally gravitated to what felt right. And what felt right was what worked right with the human visual system. And that hasn't changed. You know, the human visual system has developed over about 6 million years in humans,
mm-hmm.
but then developed probably for tens of millions of years before that in our primate ancestors. Do people assume that it's going to change over the course of a couple of decades?
Right.
Just because
of a computer.
Just
right?
because of a computer, yeah.
And
I mean,
it's not that you always stare onto the screen, you like move around and do, like you still yeah. do outside, live, well, you live outside, right? It's not.
The human being is just the same as they've always been. Yeah. How arrogant is it to assume that just because this new thing is here, that humans have changed? They haven't. The ideal way to make it work is to realise that it's this that needs to adapt to this in the same way that print did,
right.
and not this that has to adapt to this. That's the answer. Humans are not going to change. We may evolve. Homo sapiens version 2.0 may come along, but it'll probably be a couple of 100,000 years, I would think, at least before that kind of level of evolution.
Well, and you still, if you like, having screens, right? You have still, like, the normal world outside, like...
Yeah.
That would need to change, too.
Of course.
Because otherwise, this is just one small, tiny part, right?
Our system developed to allow us to survive and thrive in the world. This is just another part of the world.
Yeah.
It's not somewhere special. Cyberspace is not somewhere special. It's just another part of the world. And it's just a surface.
Yeah, I think the other interesting aspect, too, is a number of people in print have a specific way that they want theirs to appear. Like, it's like telling an artist to use low resolution or something.
Corporate identity, for example, is classic. I mean, the corporate identity of Microsoft is defined by the typefaces that we use on our websites and on our print material and so
right.
on. Apple's corporate identity is defined that way, you know, Coca-Cola's corporate identity is defined a certain way and so on. And it's all by the use of fonts and logos and graphics and so on, but it's all the same. And it hasn't changed. I mean, why do you think that is? Our perception system developed because as humans we need to make decisions all the time. Is this a threat or is it lunch?
Mm-hmm.
Where can I find something to eat? So we developed visual pattern recognition as our primary survival skill.
Mm-hmm.
So and then when you were a child, your parents and the elders in your tribe taught you the database of patterns that you could eat, the database of patterns that would kill you. You know, eat this leaf, it's good. Eat this one, it'll kill you. Eat these berries, but don't eat these berries. It's all about visual pattern recognition. It's no surprise that McDonald's, for example, is so protective of the two golden arches.
The golden arches, yeah.
Because it's the same as...
Good,
yeah,
right?
Food, good. Food good, fire bad.
Yeah, it's probably also...
Gear food, that's what it's saying. to the primitive human in us.
And the Pavlovian response, right, too. So, like, you literally start salivating when you see those arches, because it is, that pattern means food.
You, mate, I'm a vegetarian. I've been a vegetarian for 35 years.
What about
French fries? Come on.
Yeah.
Vegetable.
Yeah,
but still, like, if you see some, like, they're still, like, change the stuff for vegetarians, so
yeah.
They have their own, or, like, you know, it's almost, it's, yeah. Or Coke.
Well, let's not get sidetracked on McDonald's.
Okay.
And right, food.
Sorry.
So that's why this stuff is so important, that
right.
We have that on the web. So here's my kind of standard blog on Blogger, and here's one of my peeves: that authoring web standards pages today is like setting type in the days of Gutenberg. You know, when you had to hand set each letter, because if I want to do web standards pages, I have to do them in Notepad.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Blogger. Now this is Live Spaces, which is a little bit better. I have more of a two-column layout in here than I had. You know, I can use my photographs and so on. But once I get down beyond a certain level, I'm back in the world of, this is the only bit of text I have on the screen. All of this area is wasted.
It's the river of white, right?
Yeah.
I call it always that way, or the that.
It's completely wasted. But
yeah.
I paid for that piece of display.
It's priceless paid, right?
Why aren't you using it, you know? So that's what blogs look like. Okay, so now here's what I think a blog could look like. This is a kind of my secret bloggerzine project that I was working on for ages. I was working on for a while, but I did it on my website. It's actually live up there, but nobody's ever been there because I've never publicized the URL.
Okay. Are you publicizing it now? Because you kind of are.
Yeah, you can go.
Just so you know.
You can go now. So the URL is www.billhillsite.com/cover.htm.
Okay, we'll put the link in there just for...
Yeah, that's the link to the secret bloggerzine. If you just do billhill.com, you'll come to a front page that doesn't have links to this yet. I'll put them on now. I'll go visit it and I'll put on some links to these pages. Because there's a couple of sets of pages. But here's a... This is what a blog should look
I'll
like.
I'll tell you something, like, if I see this blog, I don't need this zoom feature down there.
No.
I wouldn't like it even, like...
The type is 12-point. Not only that...
Well, I do think the zoom feature is... Like, I look at the example of the New York Times WPF Reader, where sometimes it is really nice to be able to zoom in and zoom out, or in particular,
yeah,
if you have very high DPI.
You want to do it in a certain way, though.
Where you don't lose.
Yeah, this is not perfect yet. This is still very much a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that I want to see happen. I've been. This is the first of these pages, and actually the pages get better as I move through and get more familiar with how they're done. But here's my navigation, for example. It's paginated. There's no scrolling at all. If I want to go to page two, you know, I click on the link and I go to page two. Now, you'll notice that the typeface is very readable. This is Cambria, one of the faces that we shipped in Office 2007 and in Vista. This is Calibri, which is another of the faces. These faces were designed and optimized for ClearType, by the way. This one is Candara. So Candara, Cambria, Calibri. All the names
embedded,
started...
Right?
I beg your pardon?
Everything is embedded, right?
Using the same embedded that you were talking about before.
All of these fonts are embedded in my site, so if you're running on Internet Explorer Beta 2, or running on Internet Explorer, the font objects will come across with the pages and you'll be able to see them. Hopefully, when the Firefox and Safari guys get round to it, you know, you'll be able to see the same thing there as well. If you have these fonts on your system and you're running another browser, they will show up, but you won't get the font embedding.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my blog, and I think it's much more readable than a normal blog. And I'd like people to come visit it and try it, and realize, though, there is a work in progress. I'm not where I want to be yet.
Sure, sure.
This
gives the concept.
Yeah, this blog was designed to be read on a 1440 by 900 display or better. If it's a smaller display than that, then it might not be as good. It'll scale and you might get some space. I'm getting there. You know,
okay.
Rome was not built in a day. In fact, what I'm doing on these projects is I'm kind of I'm kind of opening the kimono very early, right? I'm letting people watch as I learn. In fact, I say that back here. This is my secret blogazine in which I'm going to try out some ideas and develop some production methods. You know, I've done 30 years of producing print. I've worked in newspapers and magazines and so on. And I'm trying to bring that knowledge to the web.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I say, I don't think there are any unknowns left. I think that everything I need to do, I know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a question of being able to get there. So this is a blog, but I also thought I'd like to try it for a really sustained read, like a book. So this is a book called The Mabinogion, which is a 12th century Welsh manuscript. It's kind of Arthurian Welsh legends. I pulled the text off of Project Gutenberg on the web. Right. Project Gutenberg has all these great texts, but have you ever tried reading one in Project Gutenberg?
It's literally just a straight text file. You copy it into a Notepad, it opens up in Notepad and it's hell.
Yeah, it's hell. It's absolute hell to try and read these things. So what I thought was I'd try to take the same text and produce a readable version of it. I want to do the whole book. I have done so far about 100 pages of the book, which represents about 50 web pages. But here are my page turns. I can go to the next section or the previous section. You'll notice, again, I'm using Cambria in here because it's a really good readable face. You'll notice it's a double column layout.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather have a two column layout than a three column layout. Interesting. The optimum width of a column for reading is probably about this. But, you know, when you're reading something of this kind of character, you actually want to slow down a little bit. What you don't want to do is make reading so efficient that people just kind of skim through it. You actually want people to absorb it. And I've been noticing this myself.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when, you know, when we read a book, there are times when we slow down. If you're reading poetry, for example, you read poetry much, much slower than you read an action thriller where you want to get to the next shoot 'em up bang sequence. Right,
right.
This kind of subtlety was not really possible on the web before, but it is now. And I actually find myself wanting to use it. It's really cool how close we are to getting to really bringing reading over to the web and making it a great experience. So I've done 50 pages of this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things I wanted to show you, let me bring...
And this is using IEA. It doesn't even matter because you said this page would load the embedded fonts.
It would load the embedded fonts in earlier versions, but I don't think the JavaScripts that I'm using for multi-column and for hyphenation will necessarily work with the earlier versions.
Okay.
I know they work with other browsers because I've tried it, mm-hmm. But they don't work with earlier versions.
Okay.
And there's I'm uncovering bugs along the way also. Mm-hmm. So that's another good reason for doing this kind of project. So I'm kind of stress testing Internet Explorer and its display capabilities in a way that I guess nobody else on the team is, because they're actually building the thing. And what I'm doing is I'm taking it, exercising it, and stressing it. You know, I have one page on here. The way I work on this is I lay the pages, I bring in a big slash, a big chunk of text first, and then I chop it up into sections. Once I've done various global search and replace operations on it, because I want to replace inch marks and foot marks with proper typographers open and closed quotes and things like that. So I do search and replace to clean all that stuff up. And then I bring it in and do HTML. And if you look at the HTML in here... So this is all the kind of head stuff, which is defining page numbers and calling the JavaScripts and setting up using these two W3C logos to tell people that they're totally standards compliant.
And the tool you're using, this is new to IE8?
Or no, this tool is actually... this is Notepad++ I'm using here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But
I see colorization, line numbers.
Yeah, actually...
But that's actually in the source code, too. Like, if you open source code in IE8, you get this.
Yeah, that's
right. Well, that's what I was going to ask, if it was the embedded one or not.
No. And Expression Web does the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, Expression Web. If you stay in the HTML view of Expression Web, it does the same thing. But I happen to.
So the point here is, like, instead of just garbage HTML, I just see classes defined for UI.
There are a few bits of things in there, like this is an eacute character, for example. So I've got to do the code for that. So there's a set of typographer's quotes. Open quotes is and slash 8220 semicolon, and closed quotes is and slash 8221 semicolon.
Right? Of course.
Well, how friendly is that? You know, I mean, I really want a tool that just says, "Hey, you've done open quotes. I'm going to write the piece of code for you. You don't have to paste it." I had to paste each one of those in. Okay, so global help and search and replace helps me a lot, but try doing global search and replace, for example, for typographer's quotes. Because the opening quotes are different to the closing ones. So you have to do a global search and replace inch marks with and slash 8220. But, so find me the first one, replace that, but skip the next one and replace that. So if somebody could give me a replace every second one, mm-hmm. as opposed to a global search and replace, then I could automate it. But I can't. Once I've done the first one, though, of course, I can then do a global search and replace all the remaining inches marks with the closing quotes. Right? Apostrophes are not as hard. But so there's a lot of stuff like that could be cleaned up. So what other things I want to do is I want to start feeding back this information to the authoring tools people. Yeah, I'd love it if in Word I could just spit out HTML that was that clean. I mean, this is as clean as it gets.
Sure.
There is not a single character of formatting in there at all. Mm-hmm. Not one. And I've been deliberate about trying to pull all that out. The CSS, actually for a book it's fairly straightforward. For the blog it's a lot more complex because I'm defining the pull quotes in CSS. And there's other interesting things you have to do. I mean, one of the issues when you're reading is you want to see, there are all kinds of subtle things that you don't realise are going on. For example, when you're reading a magazine and there's three column text, one of the things that gives a page stillness is the fact that the baselines of the text in the three adjacent columns are all the same. All the text is sitting on the same baselines. Right?
What do you mean by that? By baselines?
The baseline, say where the lowercase b or the lowercase n sits. It's all sitting on a baseline.
You have one line that goes through the whole
That's the baseline right here. And if you drew one line underneath, it would go through them all. And that gives a page stillness. It's actually quite difficult to do that because this is a different type size. And there's some space in here, and there's some different spacing in here. So what you have to do, for example, is make each of these different elements a multiple of the line height of the standard body text. And if you do that,
then you get it.
Then they always hit.
Interesting.
Right. Now, there are ways you could do that automatically. So there's a whole bunch of things like that where I'm collecting a set of requirements that I'm going to be going back to into the Explorer team and to the tools guys and saying, love it if you could do this, you could do this. You
know. Right.
However, having said that, I'm really delighted with how readable I've managed to get stuff already in IE8. Even though I've had to resort to using bolt-on things like JavaScript for multi-column and hyphenation just now, these things will come.
Yeah.
We're still in early days yet. I mean, it took 400 years from when Gutenberg invented movable metal type. It took 400 years before Ottmar Mergenthaler and James O. Cleffein invented the linotype machine that would set a whole line of type.
Oh, fascinating.
Have you ever seen those machines, by the way? They're incredible. No. There's some great videos out on the web. There's a fantastic video, it's about 45 minutes long, explaining the workings of a linotype machine. It's unbelievable, these things. You know, there's all these arms that move, and there's a vat of molten metal at the back of it, and it sprays it into molds, and, you know, it's incredible. I'll collect a bunch of URLs like that and I'll throw those together for people who are interested. I started work in the print industry in a room, well, in a newspaper that was still using hot metal. So they were still using those linotype machines. And that's how I learned to do typeset. Well, I didn't do the typesetting. I did the markup and the editing and so on. And I did the stone subbing, you know, where you have to go down and decide which lines you can pull out. So you have to be able to read upside down and back to front from 6 feet away. Because the tape's upside down and back to front as well.
So funny.
So you have to be able to read like that and edit like that. You know. You say to the compositor then, "Oh, take those three lines out and just throw them away." And see that comma in the middle of that paragraph? Well, cut the rest of the line by machining down those letters, and see where the comma is. Just take your steel ruler and nick the edge off the comma and make it a full stop. That was the kind of editing decisions you had to make back in those days, when Men Were Men and deodorant had to be industrial strength in a place where there's all this hot metal and machinery and stuff like that. Yep. So that's kind of where I started from. But as I say, it took 400 years to go from placing individual characters to being able to set a line of type. We've been doing the web for how long? Went mainstream about 1995, and it really started. I can remember going to the web, I think in 1992 or 93, using NCSA Mosaic. Mm-hmm. I can remember going on at that time. So that's how long we've been doing this.
What?
Is my math right? 16 years? If we call it 1992, call it 16 years.
Sure.
It's no surprise we're not there yet. You know, we've come an incredibly long way, and we can learn from all the lessons of the past. But we have to do that. We have to realise that the past is not something to be thrown away.
Sure.
It's something to be learned from. This whole world of print has 550 years of learnings in it.
What's interesting is sometimes if you look at the reading experience, hasn't really changed that much in the web in, say, 10, 15 years or whatever. But in internet time, that's like 75 years in internet time. Like, it really just hasn't changed that much, and what things you can do to sort of redefine the experience.
Well, that's kind of where I'm at. I think we're at a point where over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to solve the problems of reading on the screen. I say solve, they're already solved. We're going to implement the solutions for reading on screen.
Bringing that to the masses.
3 to 5 years, make it mainstream. At which point, you know, we'll be there. And the great thing about it is that if you add all that to the incredible ability to distribute text and gather text from anywhere, that makes the web such an incredible tool. You know, that's what my Digital Declaration of Independence is all about, which I spoke about earlier on in Channel 9. That's what it's all about. I believe that people are right, that the web is revolutionising our lives. It's just that we have to be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. Right? I believe we should throw away a lot of print. I don't think we should be doing very much printing at all going forward. I think I'll still buy some printed books, but more and more I'm kind of tending to read them on screen. I've got an Amazon Kindle and I'm using that to
fun. I'm going to take yet another rat hole, but Kindle, can you give me the quick and dirty what you think of Kindle?
It's just about good enough for a version 1 product.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good enough that I'll keep using it for a while. I really love the way I can buy my books from Amazon on it, though. I love it. Although, both places I live are actually outside of Amazon's WhisperNet, so I can't use the device, but I can use my laptop. I use my laptop and I buy books. And, hey, I'm quite sure it will be there.
Yeah.
Because it's always there, you know.
I've never seen it, actually.
Yeah. The e-ink display is not quite as nice as I would like. It doesn't have quite as much contrast. So in poor light conditions, it's not very good. I much prefer this kind of setup in poor light conditions. It's not very good. I don't like the way the page turns. It kind of flashes at you because the XOR the whole thing, right, to kind of clean it and refresh it. So I don't like that. That's kind of jarring. On the other hand, when I'm reading a book, I'm not turning pages every 5 seconds, you know. So I can kind of put up with it.
Right.
I think these things will get better. I'd like to see, you know, I still think a backlit display is a better bet because it lets you read in, you know, in a whole range of places. A transflective display is the ideal.
In what kind?
Transflective. So it's reflective when you turn the backlight off and you can read in bright sunlight.
Oh, excellent, yes.
But in a low light condition. Lots of cell phones, PDAs are like that, you know. And displays like that are kind of a good idea. The other thing that is a problem with the e-ink type displays is screen refresh, you know, and colour. They have no colour. E-paper people have been talking about doing colour displays for as long as I've been tracking e-paper, which is something like 10 years. At least 10 years they've been talking about doing colour, and they've been talking about getting the screen refresh rate up. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen either. You know? I think the problem is it's a mechanical process. Right? E-paper, you know how it works. There's these tiny little balls embedded in a static charge. They're white on one side and black on the other, and a static charge makes them turn.
Turn around, right?
Well, I think the problem is that's a mechanical process. You know, you're up against the laws of friction and inertia, and it may not be possible to speed that up.
Sure.
Whereas here you're up against, you know, you have electronics working for you, doing the gating rather than a mechanical process.
Yeah, I think they went. I mean, the problem is always battery life too.
Yeah. Right?
So if you had,
It's very good for battery life.
Yeah, because it needs it like for turning page.
That's right. That's very good for battery life, but not very good for reading in some conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good in reading in some conditions that this doesn't work very well in. You know. This particular, you know, a standard laptop display doesn't do very well outside in bright sunlight, whereas that does. So it's kind of horses for courses. I don't think we're going to have the one device, but I would like to be able to read really comfortably on any screen,
mm-hmm.
and we can get there. I know we can get there. I know what it takes. I can describe everything that's necessary to give us a reading experience that is better than paper. I can do it today. A higher resolution display, adaptive layout so that it adapts to the display that you're running on, resolution independence so that the type is the right size. There's another area, of course, where you don't necessarily want to set the type to a fixed size. You might want to let the user put the type up in size because, you know, they have vision issues, for example. So you might want, now you want to be able to adapt your layout in that case.
Right.
So for print, designers have always exercised this firm control over everything to the 1/1000th of an inch. Right? I think they have to let go along a couple of axes on the web. One axis is the screen that the customer is using, and another axis is the customer's preferences. So the New York Times Reader, for example, lets you put the size of the type up, and then relays out the page accordingly.
Exactly.
That's what should happen. The designer who designed the corporate look of the New York Times still has, you know, the corporate logo is used properly, it's the right corporate typeface, etc., etc., but they've had to relax control of some parts of it. You know?
Now that's something that we haven't had in, like, print, right?
No, but it's something we can have.
You have this sheet of paper, mm-hmm. and I print on this sheet of paper, and I can lay out it like pixel by pixel, right? And here's more like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It should work, but you know, it should scale somehow.
But we can learn a lot from the history of print, you know. Shall I tell you a little story? You know where the letter A came from?
No.
Right. So here's a great book called The 26 Letters by a guy called Angus Ogg.
Is that the history of every letter?
Yeah, yeah. It kind of looks at where the letters came from.
All right, sorry.
You can actually still find a copy of that on the web. Oscar Ogg is the guy's name.
Okay.
The letter A began as a picture of an ox. Right? An ox with two horns.
Right? But upside down.
Yeah. The Phoenicians took it from the Middle East, and it got turned alpha. Right? Mm-hmm. And then the Romans eventually turned it that way up, and we had the letter A. It's actually we don't realise how much of history we carry with us every day. Let me see if I can find some other letters. Yeah. So. These are Egyptian hieroglyphs, you can see I keep my bookmarks in my pages, but I don't know what the bookmarks actually mean. I just know it's something interesting. I know I wrote something about it there. Yeah, see. So, Daleth was a Phoenician word which came from the Egyptian for a hieroglyph that looked like a door, mm-hmm. which became a simpler symbol, which became that symbol, which became that symbol, which became that. There's the letter H, fence, right? The letter K.
Whoa, the K changed.
Yep.
What was it doing? Like, what was the meaning of that guy?
Calf, the palm of the hand.
Oh, that's a hand in the beginning. Like, now that's no hand anymore.
Yeah.
Wow. You could never do that.
That's
interesting.
The hieroglyph for owl became the word M. And the letter M.
Interesting.
It's fascinating. And we have to realise that stuff that we just kind of take for granted. We've been doing writing systems as human beings. Writing systems first emerged in the Fertile Crescent of Mesopotamia, what is now modern-day Iraq, was where humans invented writing about 5,500 years ago.
So is this before the Egyptians?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Okay. Trying to do my timeline.
I think the Egyptians are about 3,000 BC.
Okay, I thought they were more than that, so.
I could be wrong.
Okay.
I don't know. I could be wrong. I've been wrong before, I'll be wrong again. We have all this history that we bring with us. I believe we actually learned to read millions of years before then, before we even had writing systems. What did we read?
Symbols on a cave.
We started off by reading tracks, animal tracks.
Oh, interesting. Hey,
let's go to the whiteboard again. There's something else to...
Some letters that haven't been...
Here's my theory, and I've run it past all kinds of linguists and cognitive psychologists, and everybody seems to think it makes sense. Right. So, one of the... It's not my phone. It's his. So one of the first things primitive peoples have to teach their children is animal tracking for hunting.
Sure.
So there's two ways that they use to teach animal tracking. I'm an animal tracker, as you know, and that's one of the reasons I've learned so much about reading.
Are you really an animal tracker?
Yeah, I've learned it all from.
Fascinating. Okay.
A family of wolves and a male, 175-pound male cougar taught me everything I need to know about how humans read.
that's a great quote.
It's true. I mean, a cougar followed me home one time.
Oh really?
Yeah, I live out at the edge of the wilderness, out beyond the east of Redmond.
Okay.
And I found a place up behind my property, right in the wilderness, where a family of cougars was denning. There was a female.
Oh.
She had two kittens, and the male would swing through every now and again. I didn't see them all. I didn't see them, I found their kitty scrapes, you know, like your cat does. These were like 3 feet long. And the dumps had hooves in them and things like that. So it was obvious who won. There was bones scattered all over the place. So I spent the whole day tracking these guys and figuring out what they were doing and realising that they were moving around the woods while I was there, by the way.
So they were tracking, yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course, because they're very curious. Anyway, the next night, I'm sat at home, I'm playing guitar, and my son, Eldon, pops his head round the door of my studio. He says, "Dad," I said, "What is it?" "There's a cougar at the front door." It was the male, the 175-pound male. He had backtracked me all the way from where he lived to my front door. Just because it was curious and I wanted to know why I've been spending so much time where he lived. And it was also sending a subtle message.
Yeah, yeah.
You know where I live and I know where you live, right? So if you're an animal tracker and you live where I live, you're operating on a whole different level when you know that the guy who's teaching you, the cougar, might be watching you at any time. It puts you in a whole different place.
Sure.
It puts you back into the place where the people who did the tracking and the wilderness stuff in the beginning were. You're actually in the wild. You could get killed if you're not paying attention and you're not really there. Yeah. Right? So you have to do that. I was taught to track and taught wilderness awareness skills by a guy called John Young, who was taught by another guy called Tom Brown, who's a really famous tracker, animal tracker, who has a whole school on the East Coast. So, anyway, primitive peoples teach the kids to track in two ways. First of all, they draw tracks in the sand, right? Mm-hmm. And they teach them to tell the stories that go on the track. So I've done this for C4 before, but you know, when a long-legged animal walks, because its back and front legs are the same length, its rear track lands in the same place as its front paw. Mm-hmm. That's called direct register, and you can tell when an animal's moving faster than normal because the rears land in front of the fronts, are moving slower than normal, and then you can figure out, you know, from tracks whether it turned its head and what it was looking at and what was going
on.
You can
figure out if it turned its head?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Easy.
Oh.
Movement of the front two kind of off axis.
Well, it does that
changing weight. There's all kinds of things you can tell. You can tell roughly what age an animal is, whether it's a male or a female. Breadth of pelvis, so therefore breadth of back legs. Whether the female's pregnant or not, because if she's pregnant, the belly swells and the rear feet turn out more and more, so you can tell how pregnant she is, how close she is to giving birth. Whether it turned its head, what it was paying attention to. So John Young would take me into the woods and show me a whole story in the tracks. And then I realised, you know what, I'm reading. Now think about what happens. You're a primitive man and you've been used to drawing tracks in the sand and reading the stories in them. So then you say, well, you know, if I made a track like this, I've got a man, and maybe I'll give him a bow. And I make another track like this, which is a deer. Right? And then I make a track like this, which is an arrow. And I make a track like this, which is the deer dead. What have I done? I've just written a story. Now, go back to Oscar Ogg's book and look at...
And just so you know, I am getting the flashing red that we may be out of battery, so...
Primitive cave painting.
In case we die quick.
Let's see if I'm... see? You can see how these things evolved.
Right.
So, you know, we have to... That's one of the things we have to realise. We have to realise that we carry the past with us. We carry millions of years of it with us. And sometimes we kind of take it for granted, but when you start to study it, mm-hmm. is when you realise what's broken and how you can fix it. And that's kind of what I do more than anything else.
You need the deep understanding of the basics to get, like, evolve to the next step.
Sometimes you need to go right back to the woods. It's just you and your knife and whatever else is out there, right? To get yourself back into that mindset that we've all forgotten. You know, some of the... I have like 21 Microsoft patents. I guarantee that every single one of them is related to things I've discovered when I was out in the woods, or thinking about being out in the woods, or thinking about how the human perception system works. Every single one of them.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Let alone 21 patents. Awesome. So
that worked.
Yeah, I think it was great. Thanks.